Hello there, Peabody here. Once again, it is time to take another revealing peek back into history.
What famous date shall I set it to today, Mr. Peabody?
All the way back to 2008. Ruination, the early years.
I am King.
And I am Gail.
And welcome to this in-depth exploration of the archives. We are jumping right into Ruination, the early years.
Yes, welcome. And, you know, today we have a really fascinating mission. We are going to dig into a very specific, totally pivotal week in July of 2008.
Right. In the life and stories of the Big Fatty Online Universe.
Exactly. And if you've been following along, you know his world is anchored by that classic catchphrase. It's not just ruined. It's me, Big Fatty Online.
I love that phrase. It really sets the tone for everything we're going to talk about today.
It does. And we are tracking this wild narrative arc. We're moving from this sweltering, I think it was 88-degree heat wave in San Francisco.
Oh, yeah. An 88-degree heat wave in San Francisco is basically a state of emergency.
Right. And it's just packed with these explicit, boundary-destroying listener meetups. And then it transitions all the way to a 98-degree, profoundly solitary come down in Palm Springs.
It's quite the tonal shift. But, you know, if you want to build a fiercely loyal, cult-like following today, the conventional playbook tells you to project absolute authority.
Oh, totally. Flawless curation.
Exactly. You build a studio, you acoustically treat the walls, you script your talking points, and if you travel, you know, you document the sweeping vistas and the VIP access.
You create this massive barrier of aspiration.
All right. But what happens when you completely invert that model?
Mm.
I mean, what happens when a creator builds a massive universe, not by being aspirational, but by broadcasting his gastrointestinal distress?
Oh, my God, yeah.
And his impulsive, terrible tech purchases.
Mm.
Or just his sheer exhaustion.
Well, you get absolute, unfiltered loyalty. Because you stop being a broadcaster and you start becoming a mirror for the audience's own chaotic lives.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So let's start with the physical reality of this trip, because the environment dictates the audio.
And the audio is the entire product.
Exactly. Big Fatty has left the highly controlled environment of his normal setup, you know, the fat cave.
Right.
He and Miss Kitty have flown Alaska Airlines from Atlanta to San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And immediately, the structural integrity of a quote-unquote professional production is just thrown out the window of the BX Motor Lodge.
Literally out the window.
Yes. The windows are open. Miss Kitty is out on the veranda having her smoky treats, and you can hear all the street traffic.
But it goes way beyond just street noise. At one point, he casually narrates to the audience that the people in the room directly above them.
Oh, I remember this.
Yeah, he says they sound like they might be having sex.
Wow.
And he doesn't pause the recording. He doesn't try to isolate his vocals or wait it out.
He just keeps going.
He actively weaves the potential of upstairs coitus right into the fabric of the daily log.
See, that is the technical paradox that drives me absolutely crazy.
Right.
Because he specifically bought a new piece of equipment for this trip.
The microphone.
Yes. He ditched his clunky old USB headset and went to what he calls the Apple Snack Store.
Which is just a great name for it.
It really is. And he buys a blue snowflake microphone. Now, for anyone who knows early 2008 audio gear, the snowflake is a condenser microphone.
Right, and those are...
Condenser mics are notoriously sensitive. I mean, mm-hmm. They have a diaphragm designed to pick up every single acoustic reflection in a room.
Every little sound.
Right, so taking a condenser microphone into a motor lodge with open windows is, objectively speaking, audio suicide.
Which, you know, really raises the question of intent.
Exactly. Because he explicitly tells the audience he didn't read the spec sheet. He bought it simply because he liked the name Snowflake.
That is so funny.
I have to look at this and just call it what it is. It's reckless, aesthetic-driven consumerism. It's like buying a chainsaw because you like the color orange, completely ignoring what the tool is actually designed to do.
Right.
I mean, he bought a mic that actively ruins his audio quality.
I see your point on the technical side. I really do. But I actually completely disagree on the outcome.
Really? How so?
Well, you are looking at this through the lens of traditional broadcasting, where the goal is a dead room and, like, pristine vocal isolation.
Sure. Standard best practices.
Right. But we have to look at this through the lens of Irving Goffman's sociological theory of the front stage versus the backstage.
Okay, lay that out for us. What does that mean in this context?
So in media, the front stage is the polished, rehearsed performance. You know, the news anchor sitting at the desk.
Right. Everything is perfect.
Exactly. But the backstage is the messy reality behind the curtain. And the magic of early raw audio journaling is that it invites the listener into that backstage.
Ah, I see.
By using this highly sensitive condenser mic that picks up the street noise and the cigarette lighters and the squeaking bed springs upstairs.
He is providing auditory proof of his authenticity.
Precisely.
Yeah.
It creates an incredibly immersive soundscape. You aren't listening to a guy in a studio talking about a motor lodge.
Right, yeah.
Your brain processes the spatial audio and kind of tricks you into feeling like you are literally sitting on the edge of the mattress next to him.
So the terrible audio engineering is actually like a psychological Trojan horse for intimacy.
That's a perfect way to put it, yes. And that immediate boundary-pushing intimacy is a clear pattern with him.
Oh, definitely.
Just look at how they handled the Alaska Airlines flight to get there in the first place. He recounts finding out that one of the flight attendants had a birthday coming up on July 5th.
Oh, no, I know where this is going.
Yep. He immediately asks her if she'll be receiving her birthday spankings.
Oh, my gosh. He treats a stranger, like a professional in our workplace, with the exact same cheeky, slightly inappropriate familiarity that he treats his audience.
He completely collapses social distance.
He really does.
Yeah.
Which I guess brings us to the next layer of this radical transparency.
Yeah.
Because he strips away the acoustic filters of the studio, but once he's on the ground in San Francisco, he strips away all the biological filters too.
Oh, the food log.
The food log. The absolute dedication to logging the granular, deeply unimpressive details of his dietary intake.
It's so specific.
It starts with a French dip sandwich that he reviews as fundamentally terrible. But he admits he was so exhausted, he would have happily eaten Alpo dog food instead.
Alpo.
Literally. And then he pivots to a roasted chicken club with avocado and a crab and corn chowder in a bread bowl with a vinaigrette salad.
Which sounds amazing, honestly.
It does, but he insists on debating the exact tanginess of the vinaigrette. And he makes sure to note that the French fries were, quote, meatier than standard shoestrings.
The level of detail is just astounding. And we cannot forget the documentation of Miss Kitty's highly specific, slightly chaotic culinary demands.
Oh, right. The tomatoes.
Yes. She refuses the tomatoes on the club sandwich, not because she dislikes the taste, which she does, but ostensibly out of a sudden intense fear of salmonellas.
Salmonellas, plural.
Plural. And then she requires 3 entire jars of Duke's mayonnaise for a single meal.
3 jars.
3 jars of Duke's mayo.
That is a staggering amount of mayonnaise to commit to the historical record. I mean, why would you even share that?
Well, that's the thing. Documenting the indulgence is only half the strategy here. The true bonding mechanism is documenting the physical cost of that indulgence.
Oh, right. The aftermath.
Because by July 8th, the combination of travel stress, the bread bowls, the mayo, whatever else they were consuming, it catches up with him.
It really does.
He gets on the microphone and confesses to experiencing excruciating, debilitating gas pains.
And his medical solution to this gastrointestinal distress is where the logic completely derails for me.
It's so wild.
He announces he is taking a Percocet.
A Percocet.
A heavy prescription opioid painkiller for gas.
I know. And he acknowledges on the recording that it makes no sense. He hopes it will somehow magically reach his intestinal tract, noting aloud that you can't exactly poop it out or burn it.
We really need to pause and look at the actual pharmacology of what he's doing because it makes the situation so much funnier.
Please do.
Okay, so opioids, like Percocet, are central nervous system depressants. One of their primary, universally known side effects is that they slow down gut motility.
Right. They stop things from moving.
Yes.
Yeah.
They cause severe constipation and they trap gas. So taking a Percocet for gas pain is like, it's like cutting the main power to your entire house just because the bathroom exhaust fan is making a funny noise.
That is such a good analogy.
You haven't fixed the fan and now all the food in your fridge is rotting. It is the absolute wrong tool and it actively makes the biological problem worse.
It's the desperate, flawed logic of a traveler in pain. But think about the psychological concept of the pratfall effect.
Oh, the idea that highly competent people become more likable when they make a clumsy mistake.
Exactly. In 2008, anyone hosting a daily show had a certain baseline authority, right? Just by virtue of having a microphone.
Right. You assume they know what they're doing.
But by broadcasting his humiliating bodily functions and his deeply flawed, panicky medical logic, he destroys any lingering pedestal the audience might put him on.
He brings himself right down to earth.
He isn't projecting the image of a seasoned, worldly traveler conquering San Francisco. He's projecting a vulnerable, physically uncomfortable human being.
And that vulnerability acts as an adhesive.
It does. It binds the listener to him because they recognize their own messy, flawed humanity in his gas pains.
It's the ultimate counter-programming to the polished travel vlog, which honestly makes the contrast with his actual social schedule over that Independence Day weekend so jarring.
The whiplash is real.
Right. He is in physical agony in the room, but outside the room, he is maintaining a highly glamorous, explicitly adult itinerary.
This is where we see the mobilization of his community in the physical world. Let's look at July 4th at the Berkeley Steamworks.
Right, the well-known men's bathhouse in the Bay Area. He goes, and he reports back using this wonderful thematic euphemism.
I love how he phrased it.
He tells the audience he had a great time with, quote, fireworks being shot.
Which is just perfect for July 4th. And the spontaneous encounters aren't limited to the Steamworks either.
Oh no, they follow him home.
Back at the Motor Lodge, he steps out to enjoy the 60-degree evening air, and Hot Thing, he dubs Enrico Delisio, simply follows him back into his room.
Enrico Delisio. I mean, the BFO universe has this incredible knack for turning real people into these theatrical archetypes.
But it really does.
But the punchline of the Enrico encounter is Big Fatty's reaction. He doesn't brag about pulling this guy. He complains.
He's just exhausted.
He laments to the audience that he is, quote, too tired and too old for this. The juxtaposition of this young, aggressive energy following him into a room where he is exhausted and popping Percocet for gas, it's just brilliant situational comedy.
It sets the stage perfectly for the main event, though. The Hoot Nanny at the Mix.
Ah, yes, the Hoot Nanny.
This is the official listener meet and greet.
This is the moment the abstract numbers on a server manifest into physical human beings.
Real people.
And they arrive dressed as characters for the show.
Oh.
I mean, Logan makes this cinematic entrance in a black leather jacket, black pants, boots, and a motorcycle helmet.
An entrance that Big Fatty explicitly notes caused the front of his kilt to rise.
He is holding court in a kilt. Which is a whole visual in itself. Then Anthony arrives, completely bouncing off the walls, immediately trying to buy rounds of drinks for everyone. But the crux of this entire meetup, the moment that defines the era, is the arrival of Joe.
Joe is the ultimate anomaly here.
Why is that?
Well, they had zero prior interaction with him. They didn't know he was a listener. He was a total ghost in the analytics until he physically walked up to them at the bar.
Wow. And Joe doesn't just say hello and ask for a picture.
No, he instantly integrates into the inner circle.
He goes outside and shares smoky treats with Miss Kitty. And then he engages in a highly specific, very intimate party activity with Big Fatty.
Joe partakes in poppers with him.
Let's break down the mechanics of what is actually happening here for a second. Poppers, chemically speaking, are alkyl nitrites.
Right.
They are inhalants that cause rapid vasodilation. Your blood vessels expand, your heart rate spikes, and you get a brief, intense head rush.
They are a staple of the gay club scene.
Exactly. And Big Fatty brought them just to prove he had them.
Yeah.
But Joe, a complete stranger an hour prior, is the only one who steps up to do them with him.
And for this act of solidarity, Big Fatty officially christens him on the recording as his popper whore.
I mean, if we analyze this through the lens of parasocial interaction, you know, theory developed by Horton's Wool in the 1950s, we see something completely unprecedented.
Oh, so.
Normally, parasocial relationships are strictly one-sided. The listener feels a deep intimacy with the host, but the host doesn't know the listener exists. The boundary is very rigid.
But in 2008, in this specific community, that boundary was completely porous.
It was non-existent. Think about modern influencer culture. If a modern creator does a meetup, there is security, there are VIP lanyards, there is a literal physical table between the host and the fan.
Right, there's a barrier.
Big Fatty let a complete stranger cross the parasocial barrier, enter his physical space, and inhale a vasodilating club drug with him. The audience isn't just consuming the content. They're being actively recruited as cast members in real time.
I actually look at that and think about the immense physical and psychological risk involved.
Oh, it's huge.
It's like going to a Comic-Con where the fans don't just ask questions at the microphone. They climb onto the stage, rewrite the script, and start living in the house with the actors.
Exactly. It requires a level of absolute, almost reckless trust in your audience. But that trust is the engine of the loyalty.
It is. But, you know, when you are generating this much lore this fast, with this many characters blurring the lines between reality and narrative.
Things get complicated.
The historical record occasionally gets tangled.
Which requires a mechanism for accountability. It is time to officially open the vault for a segment we call Ruined Ruination.
Yes. In Ruined Ruination, we examine the archive to correct the factual errors of the past, proving that even in a completely unfiltered audio journal, there is a standard of record keeping.
And today's correction is a massive piece of pop culture history. For weeks leading up to this point, Big Fatty had been laying down a structural prediction.
Oh, he was so sure about this.
He was adamant on the record that David Archuleta was going to win the current season of American Idol.
He built an entire narrative around it.
He did. And he was completely wrong.
Completely.
The reality of the voting public crashed into his prediction, and David Cook took the title. Now, what does a host do when their grand prediction falls flat?
What do they do?
Big Fatty gets on the mic, addresses the audience, and issues the factual correction.
He owns the mistake. He doesn't edit the archives or pretend he never said it.
But he does something so much more brilliant. He concedes the objective fact. But he immediately pivots to win the aesthetic argument.
I love this.
He states that, yes, David Cook won, but David Archuleta is still, quote, cute as he can be.
It is the ultimate BFO maneuver. The objective reality of a national television vote is acknowledged, but it is instantly subordinated to his own highly subjective aesthetic worldview.
It tells you everything you need to know about the hierarchy of truth in this universe. Facts matter, but vibe and personality matter significantly more.
And speaking of subordinating objective reality to a deeply subjective worldview, we really have to look at how he processed the actual news of the world while isolated in his San Francisco hotel room.
Oh, the pop culture and news updates. This is where the show acts as a bizarre filter for the outside world.
He really is a filter.
Over this specific weekend, he notes the passing of two figures he broadly categorizes as American icons.
One was the highly controversial conservative politician Jesse Helms. The other was the famous children's entertainer, Bozo the Clown.
Now, before we dissect this, we must enforce a critical rule for this exploration. Because Jesse Helms is a polarizing political figure, we want to state explicitly and unequivocally to you, the listener, that we are remaining strictly impartial.
Yes, absolutely.
We are not endorsing, condemning, or taking any political sides regarding Jesse Helms' policies or his legacy.
Our role here is solely to analyze the source text of the archive and examine the specific, surreal way Big Fatty processed and reported this information.
And the way he processed it is just staggering. He gets on the mic and humorously admits that he constantly confuses these two men.
He confuses them.
The conservative senator and the literal clown with the red wig.
He goes so far as to claim he heard a report on another show, The Daily Purge, that Bozo the Clown was seen riding in a gay pride parade and looking unwell.
He entirely mashes up their obituaries.
I want to focus on the mechanics of this joke because it's not just a silly mix-up. It is a weaponized form of political indifference.
How do you mean?
To look at a dense, highly charged political legacy and genuinely conflate it with a man who makes balloon animals, it requires a refusal to engage with the world on its own terms.
Wow.
He shrinks these massive external cultural events down until they fit inside his own personal entertainment sandbox.
It strips the power away from the news cycle. It tells the listener, the world is chaotic and serious. But in here, none of it matters more than the punchline.
Exactly. And that need to shrink the chaotic world into manageable, structured entertainment brings us directly to his coverage of reality TV.
Ah, yes. While in San Francisco, the cast for Big Brother 10 is announced. Or, as he insists on rebranding it to his audience, Big Brother X.
Big Brother X. His coverage of this cast drop is a masterclass in knowing exactly who your audience is and what they want.
Totally.
He pulls up the cast photos and he unapologetically ignores every single female contestant.
He completely deletes them from his reality.
He even issues a direct, sarcastic apology to a listener named Straight Bob, telling him he's on his own.
Sorry, Straight Bob. He directs 100% of his analytical focus onto the male contestants, or as he calls them, the menses.
He spots a bodybuilder named Jesse in the new cast and immediately begins a structural analysis, comparing him to a notorious past contestant named Nick.
He is trying to slot this new human being into a pre-existing reality TV archetype.
If we zoom out, we can see the vital structural role that reality TV, or quiz programs as he calls them, plays in the BFO universe.
Right. Think about the narrative whiplash of this week. He is flying across the country, He is sick from bad food. He is bringing strangers into his room.
The travel narrative is entirely unpredictable.
It's pure chaos.
But Big Brother is a known quantity. The rules of reality TV don't change whether you are in a heat wave in San Francisco or sitting in the fat cave in Atlanta.
It provides a comforting, predictable anchor.
It's the connective tissue that grounds the audience when the actual life of the host becomes too chaotic.
It's the constant in a sea of variables. But, you know, eventually the variables run out. With San Francisco fully drained, the kill packed away, and the poppers depleted, Big Fatty and Miss Kitty head to the airport to transition to the desert.
And the energy of the show undergoes a massive, fundamental shift.
We're entering the come down.
The physical environment shifts from the cool, densely packed social scene of the Bay Area to the intense, isolating heat of Palm Springs.
And as the physical geography changes, the looming psychological reality of the real world begins to bleed into the audio.
But before the reality check hits, there is one final glorious triumph on the travel logistics front.
Oh, this is my favorite part.
They fly Alaska Airlines down to Palm Springs, and the victory he documents for the audience is so profoundly ordinary, it's beautiful.
He wins the traveler's lottery.
He really does. He reports that the middle seat between him and the window passenger is completely empty.
The holy grail of flying coach.
Yes. And because of this magical void in coach, he is able to buckle his seatbelt without having to endure the walk of shame to ask the flight attendant for an extender.
He tells the audience it allowed him to spread out.
This is the ultimate equalizer. You can go to exclusive bathhouses and have fans adore you in bars, but on a commercial airliner, everyone is subject to the exact same cramped misery.
Absolutely. By celebrating this tiny, unglamorous logistical win, and following it up by meticulously detailing the in-flight party mix of cheese crackers and BBQ corn sticks he devoured because he was starving,
he locks in his relatability.
He is signaling to the listener, I am exactly like you.
And that relatability is tested when they finally arrive at the Helios Resort in Palm Springs. The ambient temperature is a punishing 98 degrees.
The auditory landscape of the show completely transforms here. The chaotic street noise and the social chatter are gone.
He is recording completely solo.
He describes his physical position to you. He is lying flat on his stomach on the hotel bed.
And the only thing you hear behind his voice is the steady, rhythmic, isolating hum of the ceiling fan directly above him.
The party is definitively over.
In this quiet, depleted state, he turns his attention to his voice letters. He specifically plays a message from a listener named Eric, known in the lore as the Ham Hock Express, calling in from New York.
Eric is calling to playfully complain about the relentless travel schedule. He's demanding to know when the Ruination is going to make its way to New York City.
He wants the party to continue.
But Big Fatty uses Eric's message to issue the ultimate sobering reality check to the entire community.
He has to break the spell.
He tells Eric, and by extension everyone listening, that the fantasy is expiring. He explicitly states that he has to return to his day job. A place he refers to with this heavy industrial moniker, the coal mine.
The coal mine is the conceptual anchor of the entire endeavor.
Let's spend some time on this because it is the crucial psychological mechanism of the show. We talk about the Sunday night dread, right?
Oh, yeah, everyone knows that feeling.
That pit in your stomach when the weekend is over and Monday morning is looming. Big Fatty is experiencing the ultimate, magnified version of that dread. And he is broadcasting it live from a bed in a 98-degree desert.
The mention of the coal mine re-tethers him to the working-class reality of his listenership. It shatters the illusion of the full-time, carefree internet personality.
It completely recontextualizes the entire week. I mean, the wild escapades at the Steamworks, the kilt at the Hootenanny, the impulsive snowflake microphone purchase.
All of it.
All of it only has value because it is temporary. It is an escape from the coal mine. If he didn't have to go back to a cubicle or a desk, the vacation wouldn't be a rebellion. It would just be his life.
The contrast is the engine of the narrative. And it's not just the job waiting for him. He also brings up his local civic obligations.
Right. He tells the audience he has to shake off the vacation brain because he has auditions for a local community theater production of Biloxi Blues coming up on July 20th and 21st.
He is a guy who goes to wild parties in San Francisco, but he is also a guy who has to show up to a community center in the suburbs on a Tuesday night to read lines for a Neil Simon play.
The duality is staggering, and it is the exact reason the audience trusts him.
If we synthesize the emotional and narrative arc of the single week in July 2008, we are looking at a masterclass in serialized, autobiographical storytelling.
He took what is essentially a standard, slightly messy summer vacation, and through the sheer force of his own willingness to abandon all pretense, he spun it into a massive multi-part saga.
He really did.
He weaponized a terrible microphone to create an immersive audio landscape. He leveraged his own digestive agony and terrible pharmacological choices to prove his humanity.
He dissolved the barrier between creator and consumer, allowing strangers to enter his physical space and literally alter his brain chemistry with poppers.
He rewrote American pop culture history to suit his own aesthetic preferences. And he anchored it all with the universally dreaded return to the daily grind.
He elevated his own flaws, his own mistakes, and his own exhaustion into premium content, which leaves us with a profound, highly uncomfortable question for you to mull over as you go about the rest of your day.
Think about the mechanics of building connection.
We spend so much energy trying to curate our lives for public consumption. We hide the gastrointestinal distress. We hide the impulsive, stupid purchases. We hide the absolute dread of returning to the coal mine on Monday morning.
But Big Fatty built a global, fiercely dedicated community by treating those exact, embarrassing, mundane failures as headline news.
Look at your own week. Look at the delayed flights, the bad sandwiches, the messy, unpolished reality of your existence.
If you stopped filtering it, if you documented your own ruins with that kind of absolute unflinching honesty, would you repel the people around you? Or would you discover that your messiness is the exact gravitational force needed to build your own unbreakable community?
It challenges our entire modern understanding of what makes us compelling to others.
It really does. Thank you for joining us on this in-depth exploration of the archives. Be sure to tune in next weekend for the newest episode of Ruination, The Early Years. I'm King.
And I'm Gil.
Well, we hope you enjoyed today's trip down memory lane on Ruination, The Early Years. Join us again next weekend. We'll see you then.